Franco is pretty smart, but Franco is a child. And when it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to Advices Radio. I'm Scott McNally, and today we have Victoria Felkar. She's back with us on the network. We've heard her before a couple times now on Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. She's back today to specifically talk about the menstrual cycle. And this is an interesting conversation, at least for me. I feel like it's pretty deep and complicated. And I feel like I had a hard time getting through this interview, asking the questions the way they needed to be asked. But my thought was that I don't want to pretend like I know things I don't. I just want to keep it all on the surface, and I want to ask questions to make sure I understand as best I can. I figure that that's only going to benefit everybody else. If I can understand it, there's a better chance that you'll understand it too. My thought has been that I've worked with a lot of females that don't have a solid understanding of what's going on in their bodies. And I think that this could be a cool education for them. I think that for you male listeners out there, you'll still pick up a lot of interesting stuff. Better understanding how hormones work in your body, what they're doing, and especially for you guys out there that are using gear, these hormones are definitely at play for you too. So, I hope that you guys enjoy the show. Hope you enjoy Victoria Felkar. Next week, we'll be back with the next installment of Advices Radio Huge AF featuring Dave Crossland. Also, I wanted to thank everybody who has bought t-shirts and the ladies' racer backs. I appreciate you guys supporting the network and helping to keep me broadcasting. Without further ado, let's get to Victoria.
And I thought I heard you speak. Tell me, how do I feel? Tell me now, how should I feel?
Now I spend the way. Welcome back to Advices Radio. I'm Scott McNally, and with me today is a great friend of the show, Victoria Felkar. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me back on. I'm excited to be back after a couple months.
Well, the first question I had for you is when do we get to graduate to the point where I can call you Vicky?
Never.
Never.
Okay. I can do anything but Vicky.
Yeah.
It's like my dad when I was younger, I think he ingrained that in my head. So I have people in my life that call me Vic. I have people in my life that call me Tori. Like that. My parents call me Tori. Growing up, that it was always like that. And, but Vicky, I never, ever.
Okay. So I won't take it personally then if we don't reach that level. Okay.
No,
well, it was awesome.
Nobody reaches that.
It was awesome seeing you at the Arnold the other month. That was really cool to hang out and
yeah.
Get to go to prejudging and stuff. And you hung out with us at the Bodybuilding Nerds meetup with Dr. Scott. It was really cool and great to finally meet you in person too.
Yeah, but you guys saw me and I was a complete mess because I was all scattered from not having luggage and not having sleep. And
yeah.
So I'm glad I was still able to make somewhat of a positive impression.
So you, what was it that you were doing there? You kind of explained it to me a little bit.
I was essentially, so I had two different kind of, this is going to sound so research-like, objectives of being there. One was I was on the nutrition, it's like the nutrition supplement committee. And so the morning before the expo opens, pretty much there's a group of us led by Dr. Mark Myhall that have to just look at the caffeine within certain products that are going to be handed out, so certain like free samples, in order to ensure that nothing is in extremely high amounts because they are being served, obviously, at times to even minors, and to tell different individuals not to serve them to minors, because, I mean, you guys all know that, like, some of the pre-workouts now are ridiculously high in caffeine, and that it would make anybody have issues with their health.
Sure.
So that's, I mean, my main, like, kind of one of the main things for me being there. And then the other thing is networking and meeting up with certain people. Because it's like one of those events that you get to meet and greet and see colleagues and friends and get introduced to certain people. Like, I mean, you've got really two opportunities. You've got the Arnold and you have the O.
Right.
So I had a couple different meetings that I had set up, and then also got to meet up with different individuals through just kind of like proxy of being there, that was really, really cool. So
you hung out with Chris Bell a little bit too, didn't you?
I got to meet Chris for the first time, which was awesome, because he was a super big influence for actually like where I am today with my career. He kind of helped to seal for me. I was already having a lot of like critical questions regarding the use of anabolic androgenic steroids when I was in my early undergrad years, and when I saw Bigger, Stronger, Faster actually in class right after it came out, I was like, oh man, like I get it now. Like, this makes sense. So it was really, really cool for me to be able to just shake his hand and just say like thank you, because that's something I've wanted to do for the last over a decade.
That's so cool.
Because Bigger, Stronger, Faster came out, I think I watched 2008, 2009. So yeah, about a decade. So that was really, really cool. That was definitely probably one of the highlights of my adventure in Ohio.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. And you're so right. It's like, you know, I interact with you and other people on, you know, daily basis, but actually getting to meet in person, you're right. Mm-hmm. It's super rare. So I kind of felt the same way. It was really awesome hanging out and everything. So today we got like a pretty big topic, something I know you've put a little bit of thought into here. We're going to talk about the menstrual cycle, and this is something that I don't think there's any definitive chart or graph that is going to define any single female. And so I think it's important, probably important to you that we go in with that attitude in mind. But I think that, you know, we could all have when I say we can all, I mean me and the people that I know, we could have a better understanding of this. And it's something like I feel like you could help us with. Because here's the thing, you know, I work with some female athletes, and, you know, I've obviously known a lot of women in my life that, you know, they don't quite understand what's happening. And I don't quite understand what's happening. You know, you find, okay, I'm holding water today, and maybe they think like, well, my fat loss isn't working anymore. I'm not losing any fat. And then 5 days later, they're like, oh, it was just my period. I was holding water. And then the only answer to that is just, well, it must have been estrogen. Move on with life. Boom. That's it. Or their period stops. It's been 6 months. Well, they just don't think about it too much anymore. We'll deal with that later. So I think that in general, we could all use more of a basic understanding. So that's kind of where I would like to start. Can we talk about just what the menstrual cycle is, I guess, to begin with?
Just such a simple question.
Hey, I'm a simple guy.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. With there really is no definitive right, wrong, good, bad, high, low, healthy, not healthy, normal, irregular. Like the whole, and I'm going to use the word conversation, because that really is what it should be. It is a conversation about menstruation from a broader perspective, because ultimately no two women have the same cycles. And a lot of times women have a huge degree of variation within their cycle, not only as it relates to, say, certain periods within their life course. So from the time that they're a teenager to when they're in their 20s, when they introduce, say, more exercise, when they are, postpartum period, premenopausal, menopause. So there's a huge degree of variance within an individual's life course, but there's also a huge degree of individual variance even within month to month, which we forget about, because ultimately men and women, there's a huge degree of individual variance within our day-to-day hormonal profile.
Okay.
We like to oversimplify things in medicine because it makes it often easier to understand. But the consequence of that is that it creates these very narrow definitions that then often turn into labels of, okay, you have an irregular period, or you are doing just fine, when ultimately there is actually other things going on that have been missed because of those narrow labels. So within my research, one of my big goals and one of the things I'm probably most passionate about is being able to talk about this, not only degree of individual variance, but also how we've gotten to this point that, you know, suddenly all female athletes have a problem because they don't have the perfect 28-day period, which that statement in itself, I shudder because there's just so much more into it. So, so ultimately, I guess the first kind of, and I'm going to try to do, I guess, little takeaways after I say some really important things to highlight.
Okay.
Remember so this.
I'll wait for the takeaway then before I comment.
Yeah. Well, but even afterwards. So, like, I guess first things is we talk about menstruation, but really it is about like the female reproductive life cycle.
Okay.
Because there's other things that happen in terms of women's health and hormones that go on outside of just like the menstrual cycle. But for today, because we're trying to be as clear and concise as possible.
Yes.
We're talking about what's called like menarche or menstruation.
Okay.
And that involves essentially a shifting kaleidoscope of hormonal action in order to create some type of change within our body. And it really is, I would say, next to circadian rhythms, the rhythm of our menstrual cycle is absolutely essential to good health.
I like the phrase shifting kaleidoscope because I don't think you can really explain what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So let me ask you something as we start to get into this. We said that things are kind of oversimplified a lot of times in medicine. If you do a Google search, you will find charts and graphs that will say in week one of the menstrual cycle, this is happening with estrogen. This is happening with progesterone. Week two, this is happening. Week three, week four, so on. Are these things, are these correct? Are you telling me that because there is so much individuality that you can't really go by that?
I wish you guys could see my face right now. I'm like seriously biting my tongue.
Well, that's why you're here. And that's why I'm asking, because this is a genuine question.
Yeah.
And you got to figure if somebody wants to learn something, the majority of the time, what do we do today? We hit Google. And that's what Google's going to tell us.
Yeah. Yeah. So I call these like cute interpretations or like photoshopped menstrual cycles. So it's not saying that they're completely bogus and they're based off of nothing, but the reality is that these are so boiled down that they don't make a whole hell of a lot of sense when we actually try to start applying them to an individual.
Okay.
And while they do provide maybe a very like, not even cliff note style, I would say like daycare style overview of the basic premise, the body is so much more complicated than that. Okay. So I think that often we can do more harm than good when we look at these and think that that's it.
Okay. What I see in these charts and graphs is mainly variations in estrogen and progesterone.
Correct.
So these are obviously two of the key hormones that are going to be involved with what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else very important here that we're missing hormonally. I mean, I'm sure there's a cascade, but like if you're at a, if there's anything that's like, this is the meat and potatoes of it.
Yeah.
Are we missing any meat or potatoes here?
Absolutely. Okay. So first thing is to remember that our body is, okay. So I'm going to try, I am going to simplify things. So sorry, anybody that's like researchers or endocrinologists out there, I'm bastardizing my own conversation, but it will all come back around because that's what I always try to do.
Okay.
The body is a very, very smart like device that's regulated by something called the, for at least for the menstrual cycle, the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis.
Okay.
So we refer to this in other kind of contexts, and I'm sure your listeners are probably from guys like Scott have talked about, like the HPA or the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
Absolutely.
And that creates a series of feedback loops in order to really create life. I mean, it influences all different domains of our body, from our respiratory rates to our digestion, cognition, liver function, I mean, going to just a regular bathroom, to menstruation, to like, libido. Like, I mean, it's every, this is our master and command center, is the HPA axis. So if we take off a little piece of that, and we try to think about it just within the context of the menstrual cycle, it's the hypothalamus pituitary ovarian axis, or the HPO. And I could create a bigger name for that. I could actually go hypothalamus pituitary adrenal ovarian uterine axis. But we're simplifying this, HPO axis.
That's enough. That's enough for me. Yes.
Exactly. So within the HPO axis, your hypothalamus signals your pituitary gland through something called a gonadotropin releasing hormone, or GnRH.
Okay.
When that signal happens, it signals the pituitary gland to release something called LH and FSH.
Okay.
So LH is the luteinizing hormone, and the FSH is the follicular stimulating hormone.
Okay.
These two hormones are absolutely crucial to menstruation.
Hmm.
Absolutely crucial to menstruation.
Now, those are the same hormones that men need to produce testosterone, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So they are incredibly important hormones that signal certain actions to happen, and when they aren't in the proper ratio or amount, we get into trouble. So with the follicular stimulating hormone, it stimulates the follicles of our ovary to be able to develop period, but also for estrogen production, and then the luteinizing hormone, it is what helps to cause ovulation.
Okay. And so you're saying that estrogen is produced from the ovaries, then?
One of multiple sites within the body, yes.
Okay.
And I'm not going to get into that, but
okay,
for just our HPO axis. And then with our luteinizing hormones, as I mentioned, it causes, there's different surging, but I'm not going to even get into that yet. We're just starting super simple. So it causes ovulation. It helps to maintain what's called the corpus luteum, which is within our ovaries. Again, I'm not going to get into super minutiae biology here. We're just sticking very simple. It also helps to stimulate progesterone and estradiol production.
Okay.
And once we have these changes in our estrogen, our estradiol and progesterone, we're also creating a feedback loop that goes back up to the pituitary. And this is why we have like this negative feedback loop of these constantly kaleidoscope hormones that are happening. But it's also important here that there are things like androgens that influence our cycle and are influenced by our cycle, inhibin. So there are other hormones involved that are often disregarded when we start to discuss our menstrual cycle.
Okay.
So estrogen. So I mean, just in the most basic, simple way, we know that testosterone aromatizes, certain types of testosterone aromatize into estrogen.
Okay.
If estrogen's having an impact crucial to our menstrual cycle, well, guess what? that means that androgens also have an impact on our menstrual cycle.
Hmm. Because they're converting to estrogen.
At certain sites, again, I'm trying not to get too complicated on your listeners, but yes, at certain parts within the body, because we don't just have estrogen at the site of our ovaries. We don't just have progesterone at the site of our ovaries. We have multiple different vessels within our body that are crucial to the production of estrogen and progesterone. Okay. And again, this is another big piece, and I don't want to go too off topic, but it's another thing that we forget when we are talking about menstruation or just hormones, period. And that things like our bones are crucial, absolutely vital to our sex hormones.
Really?
Our thyroid gland, our skin, our fat cells, our kidneys. So there's so much beyond just, you know, like our, you know, like gonads essentially, that is important for the regulation of reproduction, whether it's men or women. And this, for me as a researcher, is where it starts to get really scary when I hear certain conversations in our industry, because we fail to recognize that when we start manipulating our hormones, when we start using certain substances, or when we have periods of amenorrhea, which I know we're going to get into, or our low libido for men, that we fail to recognize the bigger picture. And I know we're trying to focus just on menstruation today, but it is something that is really important to, I guess, the broader base understanding, is that sex hormones, we've got to drop the name sex from them, because they're just not important for sex. They're important for all aspects of our biological function and physiological function. And that by putting that name on them, we often just completely ignore all the other stuff. It's like, best example I can say is that I can call you a bodybuilder, but that's only one title for the multiple things that you are in your life.
Mm, I see.
You're not just a bodybuilder.
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think
exactly. Exactly. So does that kind of make a little bit of sense? And that this is a very this is why it's so complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can synthesize it down. Absolutely. That's what we're going to try to do. But that, just to acknowledge to begin with, that it's a heck of a lot more complicated than just estrogen and progesterone. It's a heck of a lot more complicated than just reproductive function or, you know, menstruation, that there are so many different things that are simultaneously having to happen in order for us to have a menstrual cycle.
Okay. I'm following along, and so far that is, and I appreciate you trying to simplify it, because I think that I think part of, I'm going to even call it like your affliction, is that you have so much information and understanding of this that there is no black and white here. Where do we go from here in our understanding? Because this is where things start to get a little bit murky for me.
Mm-hmm. As it does for all of us.
Okay. I'm glad I'm not alone.
No. Okay. So now we're going to flip over into just, let's take a step back. So when I was first starting to open up the discussion of the menstrual cycle, I mentioned that the menstrual cycle is, next to circadian rhythms, it's the most important biological rhythm that the female body has. And it's really created by this interplay, this network between our hypothalamus, our adrenals, and our ovarian, more ovaries and ovary hormones. Okay. And this brings about certain changes, not only to our female reproductive tract, but also within numerous tissues within our body. And traditionally, and this is my big traditionally, it's divided into two different phases called either the follicular phase or the luteal phase, or sometimes you'll see those little charts on Google that divides it into three phases: the follicular phase, the ovulatory phase, and the luteal phase. And these, no matter if we're using two or three phases, this is what is the kind of the underlying physiological changes happen in these phases to create menstruation.
Okay. So do you agree then, now the charts, the graphs, things are going to be this certain way in, you know, this, it's that it's this black and white. You're saying that's not true. But mm-hmm. do you agree that there is that, that the follicular phase and the luteal phase do happen for each woman?
To some extent, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And that there are, because the luteinizing hormone and the FSH hormone, those are really kind of like what's, there's a big part of the two phases that are three phases, depending on what we want to use, that are really important to those hormones. There are certain changes within estradiol and progesterone within the different phases, as well as androgens and a whole host of other hormones. There's also changes within an individual's body temperature that happens. There is in tissue, just basic like the ways in which we are, all the way from changes in like our sodium and really potassium and nutrient balance within our tissues, all the way to the ways in which our digestion's functioning. But there is different phases. I can totally get on board with that.
Okay.
I am still a female. I do experience these things head on myself. So, but the length of the phases has a huge degree of individual variance.
Okay.
And also what actually our hormones do within those phases is a huge degree of individual variance. And so the traditional, and this is a myth, that this is a complete fallacy, is that the female reproductive cycle is 28 days. That is bullshit. Absolute bullshit. There is a researcher actually that I'm fortunate enough that she's at the University of British Columbia, or was. Her name is Dr. Geraldine Pryor. And in the early 90s, she did this massive undertaking. And I'm going to try to talk about this again at the end a little bit in more detail, but called the menstrual diaries. And so the menstrual diaries was this huge cohort of women tracking menstruation, and not just the, hey, I've got my period, a whole host of different biomarkers to be able to find out like, well, really, like, what's the average length of females' menstrual cycle? Like, what's actually going on? And essentially what she was able to prove with all of this is that menstruation is really complicated, and that whole notion of 28 days is bullshit. And really menstrual lengths can be anywhere from like 19 or even less to 50 plus. Like, it's got a huge span. So when individuals first come to me for consulting, and they say, hey, I've got a really irregular period, and I'm like, not really. I mean, you just have a different ebb and flow in your cascading kaleidoscope. But if you start to map it over a year, you can actually see that your trajectory, you've got something like, for example, like 24 days, 24 days, 36 days, 48 days, 24 days, 24 days, 36 days, 48 days. So you have your own rhythm happening, and that's cool. That's great. Like, this is you. This is not irregular. This is just you.
Okay. Interesting.
So that, again, so that's like one of my big myths that I'm like passionate about, is getting rid of that whole 28 day cycle. Unfortunately, through the use of marketing, through the use of certain like oral contraception being that it is on a 28-day cycle, we've become ingrained to kind of think that and to normalize that. And that's just, it's just not the case. So now that I get off my soapbox on that one. So the first phase, so if we think about it at, so let's start when a individual has just had menses, or the bleed, Miss Flo has come and visited. And then, so let's start that it's the first day after her bleeding stops.
Okay.
Okay. So we are in what's called the follicular, or the proliferation phase. And so within the follicular phase, it really begins at the first day of menses. So the first day of the bleed happens all the way through the bleed, happens after she stops bleeding, and it continues all the way until ovulation.
Okay.
Okay. And so ovulation, I'm going to get into that in a second, but just stay with me on that.
Oh, I'm staying with you here. Yeah. I didn't want you to go too far too fast. I'm still, yeah. Okay. I'm still here with the follicular.
Okay. This is good. So with the follicular phase, you've got the development of the ovarian follicles. And so the follicles are the little tiny things that are being produced within our ovaries that not only create hormones, but also are how we are able to make babies when they are implanted with sperm.
Okay.
So this is super. I hope we're still good, because this is me trying to do my best.
No, this is solid.
Keep it on surface.
This
okay.
Is, good. Yeah, this is great. Actually, this is. Okay. I'm following right along with you, and like I said, if I can follow along, I think that most everybody else will too.
Okay. Cool. So with So I'm going to come back to ovulation after, but
yes.
Then from the follicular, we go into a changes within our hormones happen. So usually the luteinizing hormone, or LH, surges.
Okay.
And this is initiated by a rise of estrogen that's produced by that follicle. So if you remember the very beginning of our conversation, I said that there's the HPO axis.
Yes.
And that within the HPO axis, we create estrogen within our follicles or in our ovaries. So this is what's creating that. So you get this dramatic rise of estrogen that's created by this pre-ovulatory follicle.
Okay.
Okay.
So estrogen's going up at this point.
Estrogen's going up at this point. And then this luteinizing surge, it stimulates the luteinization of what's called a granulosa cell.
Hold on. Let me just make sure of something here. When you say estrogen's going up, When did you say that is? Because I think I might have personally lost you there.
All good. So it's happening within the follicular phase.
Okay. Now this is at the beginning of the follicular phase,
This is kind of, this is after it starts to rise. Like, it rises just usually again.
Yeah.
Throughout the bleed, just slightly. And then it begins a very kind of marked upwards.
Okay.
Trajectory.
And this
throughout the end of the bleed to the beginning of ovulation.
And that, and also just to clarify for everyone, you're also saying that that period of time, this follicular phase, could be any variation of time.
Exactly. And okay. That, and the other thing is that that rise can be a big sharp spike. It can be a slow little murky, like little bubbly spike. It can be one that kind of goes, dips up and dips down and dips up and dips down. Okay. And this is only one site of estrogen production within the body. This is, we're talking about the ovarian estrogen production.
Only. I gotcha.
Only. Okay.
We're good. We're good.
Okay. Cool. So as I was saying, the LH surge stimulates a process. I'm not going to get into the granulosa cells, but it stimulates a process that stimulates the synthesis of progesterone.
Okay.
And the progesterone is responsible to then signal the FSH, or the follicle stimulating hormone surge. It also stimulates a bunch of different cellular kind of productions to happen, and some divisions of oocytes. I'm not going to try to get into that too much, but essentially you're now entering from that point on, as your progesterone is spiking, you're in the luteal phase.
Okay.
So progesterone, when you were in your menses, it was as low as it gets.
Okay.
When you're in the follicular phase, progesterone is chilling. It's low. Towards the end of your your follicular phase, it often just slightly kind of rocks a little bit. But at ovulation is when it actually starts to go up quite a bit.
Okay.
And it kind of usually tapers off in terms of about the mid luteal phase. And then it starts to drop quite marked before you start your bleed. So progesterone is the major hormone within the luteal phase.
Okay. Is there, and you're talking about the fluctuation during these two phases, real world experience, what women are dealing with, is there a point here where these hormones are showing more effects in their lives?
Absolutely. And it's
where, yeah, I guess what I'm asking is this, where does this translate into real world, where, you know, oh, now I'm holding more water than I was, or I'm really mm-hmm. craving a lot of junk food, stuff like mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so two things. One thing is yes, your hormones, you're going to have certain physiological, I guess, perceived changes happening within your body during these rise and fall of both progesterone and estrogen. But they don't happen independently of each other.
Okay.
So if you have, for example, and this is very common with female athletes, if you have low progesterone and it's low, really low within your follicular phase, and it's revving up, it's trying to get ready for that luteal phase, and it goes and it's going to go from being super low to then spiking super high in your luteal phase.
Okay.
So the difference between it being super low to being super high, because that's such a big change, your body freaks the fuck out.
Okay. This is where I think people will understand it better, when they can tie it back to their own experience.
Exactly. You know? So that period is when women get like god awful stomach bloat,
okay.
constipation, they can't sleep, everything hurts them to eat because their stomach is so bloated, but they're so hungry and they're irritable and they're moody and they feel like they're fat and, you know, they're holding water, but actually they aren't, because progesterone is, it's actually really good for water retention.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, your body's just mad at you because you just went from being so low and you were chilling down low to them being sky high.
Yeah.
And that I'm like literally look like I'm conducting orchestra with my hands right now.
we should be doing a video cast here. That's what it should be.
but that difference is when you get that awful period right before you start your menses.
Okay.
Is because you just got this massive change. Now,
and that's not just estrogen you're telling me. This is a combination, exactly.
And estrogen still has a role in this feeling of shit, but it really is more, and what I'm trying to get at is it's more than just estrogen.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things I'm really hoping that can come out with this is that people realize it's not just estrogen's an asshole, but it's not that much of an asshole.
Yeah,
there's other hormones until its friends show up. Yeah, exactly. It has our hormones have such a profound act within our body. So some of the things that we notice with estrogen is that you are going to have a different regulation of substrate metabolism to some extent. You're going to have periods of time that you are able to, or you feel like you're kind of more insulin resistant.
Mm.
You've got more cravings, and that's when your estrogen is going to be higher. But with that being said, if you're somebody that has high levels of estrogen within other sites of your body, as well as high ovarian estrogen levels, when you have your rise and falls of estrogen, you might not feel that as much as somebody that, say, has lower levels of estrogen without in their body, and then that surge within their ovarian hormones creates more of a marked kind of distinction of, oh my god, I want to eat a bus.
Okay. I'm following along.
And this is why it is just truly, truly complicated. I mean, yes, estrogen. One of the actions of it is like fat distribution within certain areas of our body, and sodium and chloride retention within, it causes like edema, weight gain, increased blood pressure. But it also helps to facilitate our bone health. Cognitive function also is changed with estrogen, verbal memory. You've got serotonin pathways. You have gastric mucosal secretions. So estrogen, it does so much in our body. So when women come to me and they go like, hey, I'm estrogen dominant. And I go like, well, how do you know?
Mm.
And they start listing off the typical things like, you know, my brain is just, it's not functioning the way it used to. And I just can't burn fat like I used to. And I don't have any libido anymore. And I go, well, you know, there's a whole hell of a lot more to that than just estrogen.
Hmm.
So much more to that. What I look at is also things like energy metabolism is important. Vasoprotection. So there's a very important effect that estrogen has on our heart health. So, and again, maybe just side note, pause the menstruation right now.
Okay.
when we think about people with bad hearts that use androgenic hormones, we have to remember that estrogen, and when we fuck with our estrogen, it's going to have an impact on our heart health.
Hmm, yeah.
It's not just about the testosterone. There's other factors involved.
That's a good take home right there.
Yeah.
for men and women.
Yeah, and also our bones. So back to our discussion of like what what our hormones are doing within our body within menstruation. Progesterone, you've got things like one of the biggest things about progesterone, and I joke about this in my doctoral research, is that progesterone has both an androgenic and an anti-estrogenic property to it.
Really?
So if we want to talk about a really badass PED,
yeah,
it's progesterone.
Huh.
It's thermogenic as well.
Really?
Absolutely.
That makes me, you got me thinking in all sorts of ways right now.
Oh,
my brain just went like three different directions at once.
The brain goes, pshoom, but I'll have to come back again and talk about progesterone another day. But I'm going to talk about it just in terms of like our endogenous, not our exogenous.
Sure.
So it's not all good though, too. There are some downsides to it. But just in terms of like a very rudimentary, like this is actually a pretty badass hormone.
Yeah.
If we understood it. Progesterone, in my mind, in our industry, is often like that the ugly stepkid who, you know, estrogen and testosterone gets all the attention, right, and progesterone just gets thrown to the wayside, and everybody goes like, well, I don't really know what progesterone is. Well, it's an incredibly important hormone. It is, like I said, there are periods of time in our cycle that we're going to have more of it. It's incredibly important for pregnancy.
Mm.
So when people have, miscarriages, often it is because of progesterone levels being too low. It's incredibly important for fertilization. Some of its effects are its ability to antagonize estrogen.
Okay.
And also decrease the expression of actual estrogen receptors. It's got a potent effect on our, it's actually an antagonist to mineral corticoreceptors. So it's able to reduce sodium retention when really present. And increase sodium retention when progesterone is in withdrawal.
Say that second part again.
Increase sodium retention when progesterone is withdrawn.
Interesting. So is that where someone would feel like they're holding more water?
When progesterone is low,
okay,
and estrogen is high,
okay,
we feel like we're a blimp.
Okay.
When progesterone is high and we're not drinking enough water, we feel like we're a blimp, because you remember that if you are dehydrated, your body will hold on to water. So if your body is in a state and that you shouldn't be holding as much water because your sodium retention is reduced, but your basal metabolic temperature, because it's thermogenic, is super, super, super high, and you're not doing what you need to do to make sure you've got hydration balance, you're going to hold on to water.
Okay. Can I back up
mm-hmm.
to the luteal phase?
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like now I understand what's happening in the follicular phase. I understand the rise of estrogen, maybe slow, maybe fast. Then we get to the luteal phase, and now I understand some more of the hormones that are kind of at play here. Could you please just explain that one more time for me? Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like I might get it more now.
Okay, so we'll start with estrogen. So estrogen has, within our follicular phase, it has risen,
yep,
typically speaking. It's gone up to its highest point that it does within our menstrual cycle right before we have ovulation. It drops down, and then it continues to rise, but more of a less of a spike and more of a like a blimp, like a hump.
Okay.
Typically speaking, and again, this is just I'm going super basic. This is absolutely typically speaking.
I understand, but it could vary.
It kind of follows the same type of curve that our progesterone is doing within that luteal phase, but not to the same extent. So progesterone is going to be high within our luteal phase, it rises, then it starts to fall.
Okay.
So progesterone will come up to its highest point, it will stay at its highest point for a bit, and then it will fall in the same, just usually pattern, cyclical fall. And then at the onset of menses, our progesterone and our estrogen are low.
So if progesterone is high and estrogen is low, you tend to lose water. If estrogen is high and progesterone is low, you tend to hold water. What's happening in the body when both of them are low?
You got a very angry body on your hands.
Yeah? Yeah. How so? What do you mean?
Because if, like, when progesterone is low, you're holding more water.
Okay.
Okay, so progesterone, it, you hold more water. I gotta take a breath. Okay.
So, I'm sorry. I know I'm overwhelming you with how simple I'm trying to go here. I thank you for bearing with me.
No, it's all good. So because you've got to remember, there's multiple different things happening within the body during these, that our hormones do. It's not just as simple as, like,
okay,
water retention. And you've got sleep here. When estrogen. Yes,
yeah. And that's right? What I'm looking for. I just used the water retention, but I'm looking for, like, how this translates into what's going on. What's somebody experiencing when the hormones are in this place?
And so you want low.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we're estrogen deficient and also progesterone deficient, so when we're estrogen deficient, we have usually a higher level of cortisol.
Mm.
We have a lower level of T3.
Mm. It's not good.
We have usually a lower level of fat mass, but a higher level of glucose dysregulation.
What does that mean?
Highs in, like, we're not insulin resistant because we have low levels of estrogen, but we're also in a metabolic state that's that opens us up to, because usually we also have higher levels of androgens, and then the higher levels of androgens within other sites of our body actually help to create estrogen in other sites of our body outside of our ovaries, and then that kind of creates this hyperinsulinemia response within, like, our fat cells. So it gets ugly after a while. Usually have high levels of, or like gut disturbances as well, because your gut, you're not creating the same type of, so you've got estrogen receptors that help to modulate our gut health. Our TSH has dropped. Our usually response to, like, things like endorphins and dopamine, they're not working the way that they should. We have really shitty energy.
Mm.
We open the door up for a bunch of bad shit.
So this is for a lot of people, a lot of women, I imagine a really rough period. It sounds like we're probably one of the roughest of the
cycle. Menopause.
Oh, okay.
Right. Cause when we go through menopause, we're having ovarian hormones that are decreasing.
Okay.
Because we're at the end of our kind of like reproductive lifespan is the old terminology, but that's usually when our estrogen production is dropping at a fast rate. Then you also can open your door up to, like, when we have low levels of progesterone, you've got, anything from really, really, really cold, like super cold level of, like, body temperature. So you've got such a reduced impact on our actual, like, not only thermogenesis, but just basic, like, you're always cold.
Okay.
You have things like bone degradation when we talk about osteoporosis, you've got effects of estrogen, but you also have an effect of progesterone as well. Things like pituitary issues. There are influences on, just so many things in our body.
Okay. Well, that gives me a good idea. So this is as we travel into the luteal phase, both of these hormones get low, and then what happens next?
Okay. So go back again. What did you just say? When we go into our luteal phase.
You're in the luteal phase, and both of these hormones come down basically
at the end of our luteal phase.
Okay.
Prior to menses.
Okay. And then what happens? We start it all over again.
Exactly.
Okay.
the clock starts again. Now, so here's kind of where some variations come in, though. Within the luteal phase, so I want you to think almost like that your estrogen goes throughout the luteal phase, your estrogen goes up and it comes down, and progesterone goes up and it comes down. But that's not a perfect, beautiful, like, double hump. You don't look like you've got a camel that's got like a weird, like, you know, double hump. It's a singular estrogen and progesterone follow the same trajectory. Just progesterone goes up to its highest point, and estrogen's highest point was prior to the start of ovulation. So it was back in the follicular phase, but estrogen is still coming up. Now, in some people, estrogen actually comes up quite high. In other people, progesterone doesn't go up as high as it should go up. In some people, that curve is not evenly distributed. So their estrogen might come up at the beginning and then and fall kind of like more of a gradual fall as you go into your menses period. People might have a progesterone that spikes and then falls, or might go kind of highs and lows and highs and lows, kind of like a squiggle.
Okay.
So this is where I have issues with that whole cute Google image.
Yes.
Which I'm sure you're probably looking at right now.
I'm not. I promise. I swear I'm not.
I'm impressed by that. but if anybody does and you go and you start looking at it, that's where I have these certain things that are concerning for me when we look at those, because it creates such a skewed idea of what actually happens.
That makes sense.
And remember, we're talking gen pop. We're not even getting into the athletic population yet. Because the athletic population is its own it's its own thing.
Yeah.
Because the athletic population, for lack of better kind of terms, is we're manipulating our menstrual cycle with or without the use of different exogenous aids or supplements. Getting into them, and that our menstrual cycle is regulated by so many different things. Okay. If you are stressed, you are going to have an impact on your menstrual cycle. If you aren't sleeping right, you're going to have an impact on your menstrual cycle. If you have hypothyroidism, you're going to have an impact on your menstrual cycle. If you then start all of a sudden on thyroid replacement, you're going to have an impact on your menstrual cycle. If you have digestive issues or bad gut, you're going to have an impact on your menstrual cycle. If you have blood sugar abnormalities, impaired liver function,
all these things are going to change
it. All of these things are going to influence your menstrual cycle.
Wow.
Your nervous system will impact it. Our body, like I said, I think I even said this in the last couple podcasts we've done, it is so complicated what actually goes on and what we have kind of decided is normal or what should happen. There's so much more beyond that. So much more. So like you break your foot.
Yeah.
And it can have an impact on your menstrual cycle because that's a stress on your body.
What kind of things could happen? Give me just an example, you know, of what could occur, you know, under one of these circumstances. Say somebody gets a new job, they're under a lot of stress, they're not getting enough sleep.
Yeah, so typically speaking, this is what we call functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. So typically speaking, when our body is not happy, aka our body is stressed, whether it's from an internal imbalance or an external environmental factor, we go into this very like evolutionary state of I'm not in a good place to make babies right now.
Okay.
I do not need to be fertile right now. I need to get my shit together first.
Interesting.
So the functional hypothalamic amenorrhea is something that I'm really passionate about talking about because I feel that it is so under discussed in across multiple different disciplines and fields, because instead of acknowledging that this is what happens, we pathologize it and we create these different types of diseases and syndromes that really don't need to be there. And we often treat people with like oral contraceptive or ovarian synthetic hormones, when all they have to do is actually look at the underlying cause of why they have no period. We have to peel back the layers and go, okay, why aren't you having a period?
Okay.
What are the reasons towards that? So within the athletic population, within and this is actually another really kind of great – so the research I mentioned, Dr. Geralyn Pryor, she started looking at female athlete menstruation back in the 80s. She was kind of way ahead of her game. Okay. And she pretty much was like, that whole notion of this energy balance bullshit of when you don't – it just doesn't – it's not that simple. And a lot of people go like, well, you have – energy balance in terms of like you're not eating enough, you're not going to have a period. And it's like, well, yeah, that's one of many things though. If you're not eating enough to sustain life for you, how are you going to sustain life for potentially somebody else? Hmm. Again, evolutionary. If you are overtraining for your body,
yeah,
how are you going to sustain life? If you are in a very kind of crazy major life stress state, how are you going to sustain your life? About your life is being negatively affected by that.
Major caloric deficit.
Exactly. Okay. That's just one of many different things, though. If you have a rapid change in, say, your weight, that your body's not in a happy place. If you're binge eating, or if you have been on such a huge, huge, huge carbohydrate withdrawal, and then all of a sudden you start eating them again, your body was going to take time to re-regulate itself. We create hormonal adaptation. So that whole menstrual cascading kaleidoscope, we create adaptations over time. So if your body is in a stress state for 1 month or 2 months or 3 months, we might not create new pathways for that cycle. And we might just put it on the back burner, yeah, and be like, okay, right now is not the right time for this period to happen. Let's just keep going. But over time, our body creates adaptations. And where this is really important to think about it is when we think about it in conjunction with, like, when we first start having a period. So when individuals are incredibly active as young females, and we're exercising as they're actually creating, then establishing this pathway, our menstrual cycle and the everything within that is going to adapt to a certain condition. Okay. And that condition is exercising.
Okay.
Okay. So there is a high likelihood that later on in life, that individual is going to have some type of menstrual dysregulation.
Really?
Because their pathways are just developed in a slightly different way, because that's how their body developed. Like, that's just them.
Huh.
If they get put on birth control when they're still creating these pathways as a young female,
which I think is real common.
Very common. Very, very common. And to be honest, it scares me, which is why, like, I did start my research on female athletes' use of birth control, because you are changing, or you're rerouting, your body is adapting to that. So when you go off the birth control later on, say at 17, 18, 19 years old, your body goes like, fuck you. Like, I don't know what to do now. Mm. Or if you stop exercising, your body goes like, well, sure, I'm going to keep going, but we might have some problems later. So then when you do go off the birth control and you've stopped exercising, your body gets in a very, very scary place. And yes, this is the whole kind of PCOS nebulous that people talk about, because you're not having normal, quote, normal menstrual cycles. You're having glucose dysregulation. You're having insulin resistance. Mm. You're having high levels of androgens. Your body is not in that, just the very basic thing. Your body is not in the proper processes involved. It has not created these proper routes. Okay. It gets confused. It gets pissed off. It gets angry. You get hairy. You get high androgens. You start craving sugar. You're insulin resistant. You're holding a lot of water. Your liver's fucked up. Your cholesterol's bad. So on and so forth.
Ugh. And as we had discussed on a previous episode, this is something that you had experienced in your own life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So kind of just going back to the athlete thing is that with I gotta take a breath. That was a good VF kind of little rant there. But when you're an athlete, I'm not saying it's good to have menstrual like amenorrhea, but I'm also saying that like your body's stressed out. Therefore, you have to try to mitigate and navigate the stresses on your body to be able to make sure it is happy and healthy.
That's got to be tough, especially for, you know, what we're doing in the fitness industry, because it's so extreme.
Absolutely, absolutely. Which is why we have to look at this bigger, broader based perspective of the body. And so if you're an individual and you're training really hard and you're not sleeping, you have two different stress triggers happening on your body. Training hard isn't going to change. That variable is going to stay the same. Okay. So you better freaking adjust your sleep and make sure you're getting adequate sleep to help you recover. If you are an individual that you are in a hypocaloric state to try to create fat loss, you better make sure that your glucose regulation is up to snuff. You better make sure that you're getting good sources of nutrition that aren't triggering other potential stresses. So not eating foods that are giving you a gastric ache, not giving you foods that are making you, you know, gassy, because that's a signal that those are triggers on your body. So you have to try to, this is, it's all about like, and I mean, I say this for men, women, like this is stress mitigation. There are certain variables we can control. There are certain things that are, you know, you don't touch. I don't touch when I work, especially when I work with major athletes, like you're training. I don't want you to stop training. That's what's keeping you sane. I just need to make sure that all the other stresses in your life are being managed so you can do this as healthy as possible.
So, and it sounds to me, so like what you might be saying here is that if somebody is experiencing amenorrhea, what they need to do is figure out the stresses, change those things, and then will that eventually reverse?
It will reroute itself.
Okay, reroute itself.
Itself. So like, and again, sometimes it's not just amenorrhea. Sometimes this is having like, when we think about you've got normal, and then you've got all the other shit that's been classified as not normal or bad. So PMS. Heavy periods, light periods, breakthrough bleeding, all the way to cramping, fibroids, so on and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of different things that are kind of like a sign of that your body's not happy.
Okay.
If your body's not happy, figure out why it's not happy. Why aren't you having a period? Because ultimately, like, periods right now, and I was actually talking to one of my groups of students about this. They're called in a nuisance, and they're called like they're an inconvenience for individuals. And I go, well, why? And then they start to tell me things like, well, it's because it's so heavy or it's painful. And I go, okay, there's something wrong then underlying we have to fix. Your menstrual cycle is nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing you should fear. It's not messy. It is life. It is part of what makes us human.
Yeah.
And so when it's disrupting your life, then we have to figure out what's going on here. We have to peel back all those layers of the onion and go, why are you actually having an impaired menstrual cycle? And then create some type of you know, action plan. Sometimes eating shit makes us have a really crappy menstrual cycle.
Okay.
Because if we're eating shit, we're becoming more like there's more chance of a blood sugar abnormality, irrelated to our sex hormones, but that influences our sex hormones, and our sex hormones are then inadvertently going to influence it.
I got it. I follow this now.
Okay, good. So eating a healthy diet, controlling your blood sugar is going to help with, I mean, just the basic tenets of getting your hormonal improved function back.
Let me ask you this. I know from a male perspective, you know, guys that are using anabolics and stuff, they get shut down. And from what I've seen, the longer that they've been shut down in their testosterone production,
the harder it has been for them to recover.
Is it
the longer that a woman is shut down, is it going to be the same?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. So male, I'm either going to lose you completely or you're going to be totally on board with this one.
All right. I'm putting on my focus cap here.
Okay. So testosterone, synthetic testosterone is birth control for men.
Okay.
You are disrupting your HPG axis, your hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, which is the similar processes of female birth control, which is changing and modifying and creating alterations within your HPO axis, your hypothalamic pituitary ovarian. Or you could put G axis because ovaries are gonads.
Okay.
Okay. So when we talk about like women, when they go off birth control, they often won't get their period right away.
Mm.
It's going to take time. Men, when you go off gear, it's going to take time. Now, there's certain processes that we talk about in the industry, like, I mean, thinking about things like PCT, and also, you know, there are actual lifestyle factors that you can implement during this time to help you get that back sooner.
Okay, yeah.
For men and women, this is like the post modification process that you fucked yourself up, and guys can get, you know, like we talk about women having functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. Well, men can also have functional hypothalamic gonadal issues happening.
Sure.
I mean, natural bodybuilders are a great case study of some of the different things that can happen when you don't have hormonal processes happening because your body's just so freaking tired and hungry.
Yeah.
And so stress mitigation, whether you're using and you're not, whether you're prepping for a show or just your average gym goer, male or female, is so important to creating a foundation for health.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm almost terrified now to even think of, you know, this is such an intricate system to even think of adding something to a female's plan like Novadex, and to think what that's actually going to do potentially, mm-hmm. how far mm-hmm. that's going to throw things off. Mm-hmm. It's frightening when you look at the larger picture.
And for some women, like think of some of the drugs that we talk about, like I think I said this on a previous podcast before, with like Novadex is actually for some individuals, it's going to actually help promote menstruation. It's going to promote ovulation. It's used as a fertility drug.
Hmm.
Because if an individual has high levels of estrogen, you want to bring them back down to a range that's good for their body. If they have different other sources and sites of imbalances, whether it's through like environmental estrogens, whether they've got like polycystic ovarian and that they've got estrogen happening from other sites that are causing these imbalances, or you know, like there's other hormones that are involved, or I should say anti-hormones, like anti-estrogens, or you can actually, there's gonadotropin inhibiting drugs. There are anti-androgens that are going to change the way in which our bodies are creating some type of a normal cycle. And I am totally open and comfortable about this topic, so I'm going to use myself as a case study here. But so I've got polycystic ovarian syndrome. I don't actually like that term. I have high androgens. I'm insulin resistant. I've been like this for many, many years. It is genetic within my family that there is an underlying actually genetic issue with glucose regulation and dysregulation. So I treat mine through a couple different things, and I don't want to get too far into them because we're going to go completely off tangent then. But one of the drugs I use is spironolactone or aldactone, which is an anti-androgen. So because I've modified my androgens, and I've actually in doing so also modified my progesterones because they're related, I have honestly, like, if I didn't track, I would have no idea what type of like circadian or like rhythm my period had.
Okay.
Because since I'm utilizing some type of manipulating agent, it makes it so I don't have an ability to track like, oh, hey, I've got 28 days. Okay. I'm 32 days. I use other variables, which is something that I think many women should get involved with doing, because it is so important to actually better understand our bodies when we don't have the bleed. Because just because we don't have menses doesn't mean we're not having cascading hormones happening.
That's what I you know what, I think that when I learned that was a surprise to me. I think that a lot of people, at least people I know, hadn't known that.
Exactly. So remember how I said that progesterone increases your body temperature, your basal metabolic temp? So one of the easiest things people can do is take a basal temperature, which means just take your temperature first thing in the morning before you even get out of bed.
Okay.
Oral temperature, not anything fancy.
And so that may give you an idea of whether you have higher or lower progesterone that day, is what you're saying?
And then you start tracking it over the course of a month. And one of the easiest kind of tips is, and I recommend this for anybody who's trying to actually get a better understanding of what their body is doing, is go get a basic scheduler, like a pen and paper, not an app, pen and paper date book.
Okay.
And start writing down daily biofeedback. So biofeedback, in my kind of definition of bio body feedback, is what your body's telling you.
And so you can look at what's happening, these symptoms. Am I feeling gassy today? My digestion's off. My temperature's doing this. Mm-hmm. And then you could start saying, well, high progesterone could be a result of these things, or high that. Okay.
So instead of – so when we think about research and kind of – again, I'm a researcher. I know this is going to sound awful. But when we think about research, you've got methods that researchers are using, and then you've got – the results of their research.
Okay.
Results, for some reason, we try to generalize onto everybody. Results can't be generalized, but methods can be applied. We can take methods and start applying them to our individual selves to be able to better understand our body and what the body is doing. So basal metabolic temperature is a method that I can utilize to better understand my menstrual cycle.
Interesting.
It's a different way of looking at things, because rather than looking at the menstrual cycle and performance as this cute little fucking spreadsheet that people are now putting out, start tracking your own, because now you're going to be able to actually figure out something. It's so much more important to figure out what your own body's doing, because say you are somebody that you're noticing, okay, this is around when I should be having, higher levels of estrogen, and maybe my appetite is shit. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And okay, my basal metabolic temperature is really high right now, so I'm starving. Oh, that actually makes sense, because if my basal metabolic temperature is higher, guess what? I'm burning more calories, it's somewhere between 300 to 500 calories extra than an individual needs when they're at their highest progesterone peak. Now, that's just basic. I mean, that's bad. I don't love that method that they did to get that actual number, but just to give you an understanding of you're going to be more hungry during that time. It only makes sense.
Yeah.
But if your estrogen is really low and you're really is really high and you're really insulin resistant, you're going to also have issues with, regulating your appetite. Or if you're leptin, because leptin and ghrelin are also influenced by this too, which I didn't even get into that, as well as you've got other, inhibin, and you've got there's a bunch of other stuff that's happening that are making so somebody could be hungry or not hungry. So there is no, I can't say to somebody, hey, you've got high estrogen, you should be feeling X, Y, and Z. I need people to start tracking their own information to figure that out. It's not perfect. Nothing's perfect in this world.
Sure, but it'll give you a better understanding, better idea.
Exactly. And tracking, there's other different things that you can track too. I mean, I'll just go to basal temp, because that's just the easiest. So if you want to figure out when you've ovulated and the approximate length of your luteal phase, you can do that through looking at the average of your temperatures. So take your temperatures from the last day of a bleed, or whenever. You can actually just pick a temperature or thermometer and start doing it tomorrow. But just start tracking your temperature. Do an average over a set period of days. figure out your average temperature that then you are able to see which ones you went higher from that average, which ones, how long you stayed above that average, and then until the day of you, like you've either, like you've ovulated essentially. So you can start to actually lay your averages out on a, oh, like across the days that you did your little experiment. So say you did your experiment for 30 days. You had your missed flow stopped. You started taking your temperature.
Okay.
And you take it from the last day of your bleed all the way to your first day of the next one.
Okay.
Say that's 30 days. Okay. So you add up the average of 30 days.
Okay.
Then you see how many of those days were above that average.
How many of those days were above that average? Okay.
Okay. And that should usually happen after ovulation. So you will be able to see a higher temperature, usually between 10 and anywhere like 10 to 16 days for like the higher temperature, which means that that happened after your point of ovulation. So you can see that if on day 8, all of a sudden your temperature went up. Hmm. Well, your ovulation then is at day 8.
Okay.
Anything following that, you've got higher temperatures. They may not be high for the whole time because remember, you've got that rise and fall of your progesterone and within your luteal phase.
Okay. So somebody takes this information. They put this footwork in. Mm-hmm. They have a better understanding of how their hormones are working and where they're at. I don't know if we should even get into this because we're coming at the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
What, how can they apply this to, I don't even want to ask. I'm just going to cut it out. I'm just going to cut it out.
How can they apply this to their training?
Yes. I'm not even going to ask it. I'm not even, but I feel like I want to ask something in there.
Yeah.
You know, how do we tie this back? How can what can we use this information for?
Okay. Now? So essentially, this is going to sound so basic, but my belief is that when we talk about menstruation, we talk about performance, we have to understand that each individual is going to have their own highs and lows and reactions to where they are in their menstrual cycle. So start listening to you and your athlete. When females have a high level of inflammation in their body, in addition to like a menstrual dysfunction, they are normally going to have, or usually, I shouldn't have used that word normally, but they're going to usually have a harder luteal phase in terms of digestion issues. Mm. And they're going to have the bloat a lot of the time. And they're when they start to actually like the first day of menses, they're going to usually have really bad diarrhea because they're getting a lot of prostaglandins released at the same time. So now you've got this individual who's got flow and poop at the same time. Are they going to want to train hard?
No. This is awful, by the way. I'm so glad I'm a guy right now.
Yeah. So no. So then don't fucking train hard that day. If you have a heavy period, squatting sometimes sucks.
Yeah.
Not because you can't squat. Usually you feel like pretty good once the flow starts, but because you're so terrified that you're bleeding through. So don't squat. Like, this is the stuff that's practical and basic.
Yeah, fair enough. It
doesn't require a PhD in endocrinology to figure this shit out. If you don't feel good, respond and react to your body. Does that mean doing nothing? No. Mm. But it's adapting. You have to be able to adapt. And coaches out there, if you've got an individual that says, I'm not sleeping.
Yeah.
Then don't push them and pretty much call them a pussy because they're not able to, you know, train the way that you want them to. Fix the sleep, and sometimes the sleep is related to their estrogen. If they're having a difficult time sweating, it's not because they're not working hard enough. Their basal metabolic temperature might be in the gutter. There are, and I could go on, there are so many different variables involved, and this is for men and women alike, that we forget and we don't regulate for. And there's a fine line between ignoring and ignorance towards our body and becoming like the Dr. Google generation that freak the fuck out over everything.
Yeah.
You have to find your own happy medium there. And you have to recognize that when you're in a period of higher stress, you need to adapt and react.
Okay. I like it. You're saying to kind of figure out what your body's doing and then respond to what you individually need. Mm-hmm. Think for yourself, basically.
Yeah, well, and don't respond with like drugs are not your first line defense.
Yeah.
Like that's one thing that always boggles my mind. Even for guys when they're coming off cycle, it's like the minute they start to feel like shit, they go back on, and I'm like, no,
oh, yeah,
you should feel like shit right now. What do you think you just did?
Yeah, yeah, no question.
And it's not a lot of times. It's like post cycle after a show, and it's like they're coming out of this incredibly stressful period for their body, and hormones aside, like sex hormones aside, like the fact that they've used exogenous testosterone aside. You're gone through a trauma. Prep is traumatic for our bodies. It is hugely traumatic for our bodies. We're expecting a lot from both an emotional standpoint, a psychological, just, you know, social in terms of our interactions that we've had to put on hold. There's a lot going on even beyond the body, let alone internal to the body. And so we fail to acknowledge that, yes, you're going to feel like shit after prep.
Yeah.
Like, good God, it's not like you're, unless you are really well managed in your stress mitigation, but I know firsthand from working with individuals that most people don't have a fucking clue about stress mitigation.
No, and even if you do, I mean, there's limitations to that.
Well, and you can't balance. Like a couple weeks ago, I spoke at Elite FTS, their performance summit. Yeah. And this is one of the things that I tried to hammer home is that you cannot have health and performance together. You can't.
Yeah.
If you try to balance them, you are going to have, like, the example I used was how many people have actually seen a teeter-totter just suspended perfectly with two kids on either side. It doesn't do that. You always have highs and lows and ebbs and flows. And what happens if you try to balance is usually you've got that one kid who's the asshole. I remember my older sister used to do this to me, and she used to try to double bounce me off the teeter-totter because I was smaller and I was getting less focused, you know, less focused on my health, and then I would always get flown off the teeter-totter. Well, there's your health. Yeah. So stop trying to balance in the first place. Balance, like, it does not exist. We have to manage our health within a state of performance.
I feel like we covered a lot here. I feel like I have a lot more questions, honestly, and I recognize that there's a lot more to it too. Like we didn't get into, like, I know that, you know, you mentioned adrenals are another really key part of this, and we didn't even really get into that. And I appreciate you keeping it as concise and as simple as you could. I recognize that it's a lot bigger than this, but I'm hoping that this gives people just a little bit more of an understanding, specifically women, as to what's going on, you know, in their bodies. I think we might accomplish that.
I hope so. And I think if I can do one parting message, that is important to also consider for, I think, male coaches and females alike, is that if you have vaginal discharge, or if you have even like the signs of red discharge, it's not always related to your sex hormones. And I'm seeing more ignorance towards this, that people perceive certain, they try to get into the biofeedback mode, but they've only kind of understood menstrual cycle. They haven't looked at things like UTIs. They haven't thought of things like bacterial vaginosis or BV. They haven't thought of things like intercourse. And so they start trying to, you know, track their menstruation cycle with an app down to the minutia, and they've only looked at one variable, aka discharge, and they fail to recognize that there's so much more. Like, this is why the body is beautiful, and it's chaotic, and it's just so complicated, because not everything is related to menstruation. There are other things happening. And so
great.
I think people being open and just knowing that, we will never know everything there is. We can be educated and we can try to do things in an educated manner, which is what I still like. That's my mantra. That's what I do. Hmm. But even as educated as we might be, we still have to be open to new possibilities and new understandings.
It's kind of amazing. I think of, like the way explorers in the past were kind of seeing what was out there in different parts of the world, mapping that out. We've kind of covered every inch of the globe at this point, but there's just, like you said, there's so much more. I feel like this is some deep exploration, and it seems like there's, from what you're saying, there's a lot left. Well, thank you for being here, Victoria. I really appreciate it. My mind's kind of blown right now. I could ask you a bunch more questions. I think this is a great place to stop, though.
Okay. Well, I'm cool with that. As long as we will one day get to those questions, I'm awesome with that.
So. Yes. And I hope everybody out there has gotten something from this. Victoria, last time you were on, I don't think you had your website up yet. Is that up and running now?
It's up.
Yes.
Oh God, I've wanted to say that for so long. Yes, it is. It is up. It is just my first and last name.com. So VictoriaFelker.com.
Nice. And where can they reach you on social media and stuff like that if they want to follow you?
I'm so boring. It's the same. It's just Victoria Felker on Instagram, and then on Facebook. I have like two pages. I pretend like I respond to both. I really do try. That's where I'm at, is Facebook or Instagram or YouTube. I am trying to post some more videos. So
nice. Where you, do you have anything coming up, in the future you want to talk about?
What do I have coming up? I guess my next two, I only have two, speaking engagements booked at this time. And that is in July, end of July, I'm speaking at the ISI, so the Irish Strength Institute, for 2 days. As a part of a speaker series that they're doing.
Nice.
And I'm actually talking about menstrual health across the lifespan, in particular directed towards menopause and premenopause, and just different both understandings but also practical just tips, tools, strategies. Nice. And then in the fall, I'm speaking at Swiss 2018, which I'm so excited about. So people start saving, get your minds wrapped around the most amazing, like, 3-4 days that you will have of learning.
That's cool. And where's that at?
That's in Toronto.
Okay.
And it's put on by Ken Kanakin. And so I would recommend following him on social media. It's Ken Kanakin or Swiss 2018. And that is, I believe, one of the last weekends in October. And I will be talking about a couple different things. I know for sure I'm doing a talk on FemChem, though.
Oh, really? That should be interesting. Mm-hmm. That should be really interesting.
We're diving in headfirst this year. Last time I spoke, I kind of tiptoed within and around it. Yeah. And there's been such a huge interest on my research on female steroid use that I'm going to do a whole talk on it.
Nice. And, that's the kind of thing I would love to have just dove into something like that here. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I just really wanted to back up, because I feel like it's understanding these basics is what I really need to be able to process those more complex things.
And that's what I tell when people come to me and they go, okay, what are some resources on for female anabolic androgenic use? And I go, okay, well, there's really nothing out there. Mm. So what do we have to do? Remember what I said about methods versus like data or outcomes or results of research is go to the methods. So if we understand basic female physiology and we understand what a drug's mechanism of action is, we create a sandwich. 1 + 1 = potential outcomes.
Okay. Yeah.
That is how we can start to understand what certain drugs are doing within the body for women. If we don't understand basic female physiology, good luck, Chuck.
All right. Well, this has been really cool. Thank you very much, Victoria. I really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thank you.
Guys, for Advices Radio, Scott McNally with Victoria Felker. We will see you soon. Now you
Advices Radio.